Welcome to Polycast, an official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site. Daniel Quick.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
Cardamandua.
With guest co-host...
Kay Madeline.
Sorry. This is episode 66, and today we have with us our guest co-host, Kelly, or Kay Madeline.
Hi.
Of course, we have Daniel Quick.
Obviously.
Imran Siddiqui.
Unfortunately.
Makalua.
Most awesome.
And I'm Cardamandua.
Perfect.
I know.
You don't have to tell me.
Perfect. I know.
200 Frigate Navy was hilarious. Gotta love the AI and particular situations that they get hung up on. This galley stuck on a single inland lake tile resulted in Victoria building 210 frigates in this game from Dalgari. Largest navy I've ever seen. She was my neighbor to the north, relatively peaceful with me. I'd already vassalized a very difficult Ragnar to the south. Caesar was the powerhouse in this game and on another continent. Victoria's land stack was surprisingly pathetic when Victoria attacked in 1860. Then her navy started to move around. I started with a few ironclads, which I'd kept in port. Any left in open water would be swarmed. After 15 turns or so, I upgraded them to destroyers and went to work. I ended up with 8 super promoted destroyers and was killing about 6 frigates per turn for 35 years marathon speed. But she kept building ships to kill this barbarian galley and an ice lake on her coastline, but could never get to it. It was a huge Tectonics Monarch-level game. So she kept building ships to go after it, and then Gary's like, oh, the galley still isn't gone. I need to build another and another and another and another.
She went totally nuts.
Oops.
Boat, get distracted. Boat, get distracted again. Boat.
So, Kelly, you have to choose a segment for us. Which one are we going to start with? Is it going to be Senate, Forum Talk, Research Lab?
But I don't want to have to pick. Research Lab.
All right. We don't have a research lab topic. No, I'm just kidding. Yes, we do.
In research lab, we talked about some ideas for dark ages to be added to the game.
Dark?
Opposite of shiny.
Oh, no!
Unless it's dark chocolate, which then means it's extra shiny.
Dan hates it now.
I must cleanse myself.
I'm sorry.
It's horrible. I can't get the filth off me.
In the Senate today, we discussed why would you ask the AI to change civs, and we talked about catapultation. I mean capitulation.
Under the miscellaneous category, a Civ 4 best game advice you ever got countdown.
And in Forum Talk, we talked about what's the point of multiplayer and the best way to set up online multiplayer with your friends, the Civ Players Out of Sync patch, and research study someone's doing for their thesis about Civilization players.
Before we get into our topics, I just thought I'd note that this is my 50th consecutive episode on the show.
Dude.
Wow.
Jeez.
Wow.
So you get a raise now?
Come on into the research lab, where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but may be in the future.
This thread about dark ages, which is kind of like the opposite of golden ages, but not really opposite, is kind of weird. His idea, he knows it would piss some people off. Can I say that, piss people off? Mm-hmm. I guess. My mother wouldn't like it, but... He wanted it to be like a message would pop up and say, a huge plague has hit your civilization, removing one plot from all cities and starting a 100-year dark age. The world is totally peaceful except for crazy people on it with no disasters, diseases, or droughts that would cause a dark age. And he thinks that's too unusual and we need to have this addition to the game. And I'm like, No, I don't think so, because that would mess up my beautiful world. But some people in the thread really liked it and thought it would be a great idea. But I don't like it.
Mm.
But then other people in the thread were like, yeah, actually, you should be able to do that. You should have great spies could be able to start Dark Ages in other civilizations.
Well,
I kind of like the idea, because that's generally how the plague, you know, in history was spread through trading and other contact and warfare. And so I think it'd be interesting if some kind of contact caused the plague or spread it from one civ to another.
Yeah, and seeing as how for Golden Ages, except for a couple of wonders, you need great people, they would initiate it. So why not have a great person be able to initiate a Dark Age? Only in this case, you want your great person not to go to one of your cities.
Right.
I started a Dark Age in my own city. Damn it. Reload.
Oops. Oops.
And actually, the thread was 3 years old, and somebody necroed it. And my favorite was Rough Pie said, further, if you pop a great scientist in a Dark Age, the unit is deleted. And if you pop a great priest, you get another one automatically. Which I thought was hilarious, but some people might be offended by that. I don't know.
And with the great spy suggestion being able to start a Dark Age, it was suggested that, for instance, if you had a great scientist, it could stop a Dark Age.
And somebody was suggesting having other kinds of great people to start something like great heretics and heathens and rebels. People were going off on this idea.
If you're going to associate it with great people, just associate it with the great people that are already in the game.
Yeah.
As was suggested.
But it would be kind of funny to do it to the other guys. I just don't think I'd like it if it happened to me.
Well, 6K Man suggested that a Dark Age not be a Civ-specific something, but something that affected everybody.
Yeah.
That it wouldn't be game-breaking, but could have an effect on everyone on the game.
Hmm.
And so as a result, it wouldn't be a random event. Some people were like, well, no, that shouldn't just happen at random. It depends on some choices you make throughout the game. Generally, I like the idea that it affects everyone. Now, I can understand people saying, well, if you're talking about this being the opposite of a Golden Age, of course, a Golden Age doesn't happen to everybody. But gameplay versus realism, yes, in history there was the Dark Ages, but we have to think about gameplay. Is that really going to be fun? And I don't think it would be fun just to be a random event, because if we are going to call it a Dark Age random event, then it would need to be sufficiently bad enough to justify calling it a Dark Age, however we want to apply that in the game. I support those people who say that's comparable of taking away what a Golden Age would give you for a temporary period of time. But maybe if it is going to be Civ-specific in a game, maybe at some point everybody gets a Dark Age. Whether it's everybody gets a Dark Age at the same time, or whether people get a Dark Age at different periods of time. And of course, that could be problematic, particularly the latter. Because your ability to address a Dark Age early on probably isn't going to be as well as your ability to deal with a Dark Age later on. The thing about having it so that with a Dark Age that there's a benefit to it, since we're talking about it being the opposite of a Golden Age, there really isn't a negative for a Golden Age, other than the fact that you've used a great person to start a Golden Age, for instance, rather than use it for some other purpose. And that's not really a direct negative. That's something you've got to take into account in the particular situation.
Yeah.
It sounds a bit complicated when you start saying, oh, the Dark Age would do this negative, but it would do this in terms of a positive.
Well, I like how Blitzkrieg says and ties in the link with the church, because the church really did take over in the form of what he calls a pseudo-empire during the Dark Ages, and they encouraged, in a way, the Dark Ages by refusing to spread education to the common people. So I think that's interesting that other things will decrease the church, and whoever perhaps owns the church would flourish. I think that makes a lot of sense. Historically speaking.
In some respects, you know, maybe that's something to consider instead of making a total random whatever. Because the main Dark Age that he's talking about, as people pointed out, was through Roman collapse. And Golden Ages are done because you've meet certain criteria. They don't just pop out of the blue, necessarily. Maybe some criteria will have to be reached, or should be reached, and then you say, okay, we're going to put you in a Dark Age because of it. Like, you're sending out too many missionaries.
Shala Grimson even ties it into civics, suggesting every turn spent in theocracy should get a 5% chance of a civ going into a Dark Age, but give it a few advantages as well as disadvantages. If we were going to do that, then I would think then, okay, what civic would give you a 5% chance of going into a golden age? Do we really want to get into that kind of game balance issue? Do we really want to tie that into civics?
No, you'd have to balance it out with a pretty decent good thing. 5% chance of a dark age, what would balance it out necessarily? It seems more apt for a scenario.
Or a mod.
Yeah.
That would make it more interesting, more complex. A random event is really like, oh, you just lost all your gold, and then you can go on from there. It's a one-turn kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree. I don't think it should be a random event. But I think it could be large enough to justify perhaps a scenario or a mod as well.
I like what Flytire says, though. He's had his own dark age before in the game. He just didn't need the computer to tell him through.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
Orb the Great is asking, why ask the AI change civics? He's saying Civ 4 is not like previous Civs, where you ask and demand another Civ to change their government because you know that that will put them at a disadvantage, like asking them to switch from democracy to monarchy. So he's asking, what is the use of asking the AI to switch? He's polled the Civ populace for their helping him. And some saying it can improve relations for one, and it can be to your benefit, such as changing it from mercantilism to free market or something.
I saw this thread, and yes, the question being, why ask AI to change civics? And I usually view it as, why change civics because the AI asks? Question mark. I don't usually try to leverage my diplomatic relations to get people to change their civics. I like it from the perspective of improving diplomatic relations more directly. If I have a civilization that is more powerful than I am, has access to me, particularly if our relationship is kind of on the line, like it's at cautious or annoyed even, and they ask me to change civics, yeah, I'm looking at a turn of anarchy to switch into that civic and a turn of anarchy to switch back if I decide to do that, unless I'm playing with a spiritual trait. But are those two turns of anarchy going to be worth it for improved relations? Because then you'll get, oh, you chose our favorite civics. You'll get that positive diplomatic modifier. And it's very situational. It could be worth to change your civics when the AI asks you. Yes, I acknowledge, Kamikaze, your point about benefiting you getting someone to change civics, but usually they're not going to change civics just because you ask. Saying, could you please change the civics just for an old friend, just because of your relationship to that point? I'd rather not use my good relations for that. And most of the time, they say, oh, will you adopt this civic because I'm trying to screw you over? And it's like, well, sure, just give us this technology. Is that really a good trade for you in the long run? Generally speaking, I say no.
Well, sometimes you want them in free market just so that you can get trade with them. You want them out of Merc because you want to trade with their cities.
That's true. But then I would also say that would probably be improving their economy. Suppose if I am in need of additional means of trade, if I'm limited in my contact, perhaps it's the only civ that I have any kind of meaningful contact with or that I can trade with, then maybe, yeah, if we're at that point in the game and they can switch to free market, maybe in that particular situation I would. But most of the time, for me, I'd rather them stay in mercantilism and have them continue to screw over their economy on their own choice.
Well, if you have Astro and they don't, then they're not benefiting from the trade and you are, if you're overseas. It's just stuff like that. I mean, there's cases where you want them to change.
Fai Calais notes that it's worth noting which leaders in your game have relatively early favorite civics like hereditary rule and caste system, since getting off on the right foot is important in diplomacy. By the time you switch to another civic, you'll probably have other bonuses from open borders and trades that you might not have had otherwise, especially if you're different religions. Unquote. That is also a fair point. Take into account who your neighbors are, what their favorite civics are, can they get to that favorite civic, what are your relationships like them otherwise, and what is their military power, at least relative to you. Other than their favorite civics, if they adopt a civic and you have the same civic, but it's not their favorite civic as identified in the game, then you're not going to get that.
It's only their favorite civic that ever counts, but you get bonus for them asking you to change. That's a different plus on the chart than if you do it without them asking.
Usually in a situation, if you're looking for a positive diplomatic modifier for civics, then first of all, I kind of think, in a way, you're a little bit desperate, but that's okay. That can happen in certain situations. I would wait until they asked, because most of the time, I'm like, you want me to change civics? A couple of times, it's like, oh, you know what? I should have switched to that. I really want to adopt the civic this other person has, but I don't want to switch to it until they ask me. That's not a sufficient reason. They may never ask you, and then you lose all those turns while you're waiting for them to ask you, and then they finally ask you. I had a game recently where getting into riflemen and infantry, and at the time I was the fourth most powerful military on the planet. This guy was number two, but he was on the other side of the continent, but he had very good relations with the civilization in between me, so I'm thinking, he can get to me over land. And I was in a war with another civilization on the other front, and I was kicking his ass. He was going to be eliminated, but my relationship with this civilization was right at the cautious mark, and I was running representation, government civic, and he asked me to switch into universal suffrage. And I thought, well, I really don't like the idea of two turns of anarchy, but it's not really going to impact my war directly. It's something that will make him happier towards me, or at least not risk the possibility of him going from cautious to annoyed. And I thought, because he has good relations with the civilization right next to me, if that one guy gets annoyed, he could drag in my closest neighbor and say, hey, you started this war with Dan Q, you should join the war against Dan Q too. And then I thought, I'm going to get screwed. So I agreed to that civics change because of all of those points lined up. And so then he was happy with me. And then for some strange reason, a few turns after I did that, he vassalized himself to somebody else, and his master wasn't even running that civic I just switched to, and I was like, oh, for God's sake.
I love that.
But now you got capitulation.
Ta-da!
I will never capitulate. What?
Capitulation spelled a couple different ways.
Catapulation.
No, catapultation. That's different.
Well, Sif4Rox personally loves catapultation. But sometimes he can't get someone to catapulate, and it bugs him. So, he wants to know how to have people catapulate, and wonder if they're just some leaders that just don't catapulate do to pride. Is he typing this on, like, a BlackBerry or an iPhone or something?
Could be.
Yes, we know what you mean, Sif4Rox. He says, eventually I surpassed my allies in strength and started taking cities, but he didn't ever capitulate. I had two vassals already, and he was being attacked by the Holy Romans and me, both of whom were many times stronger. Are there some leaders that just don't capitulate due to pride? For those wondering about vassal states, it was introduced in the Warlords expansion. There are two ways that you can acquire a vassal state. During peacetime, post-feudalism technology, a civilization may voluntarily become a vassal. And the vassal, not the master, is given the option to renew the relationship after 10 turns. But here we're talking about a vassal relationship that arises during wartime and is referred to capitulation. Differs from the peacetime arrangement in that the vassal can't break the relationship unless A, it grows to more than half of the size, land, and population of the master, or B, loses more than half the territory it owned at the time the agreement was created. As people are pointing out here, I think it's very atypical to get a civilization to capitulate and become a vassal when they themselves have a vassal. Usually I have found that that will happen when the other civ that I am hoping will become my vassal loses his or her vassal. And that is usually a sign that they're sufficiently weak that I may just in fact be able to get the former master to this vassal to become my vassal. But as the Mian team puts it, capitulation is very convoluted and crappy. The Mian team says civs won't capitulate unless they're weaker than the average of all civs, modified by war success. I assume modified by war success meaning success against them. Whether or not they're a land target to another civ warring with them, your power is higher by enough, quote-unquote, and by enough is, of course, a relative term. And the next one is they get a power boost for having a vassal, even as the vassal kills the average. I'm not sure about that one, because it's civs won't capitulate unless they get a power boost for having a vassal. You mean they get a power boost for becoming a vassal? They're more secure because they have a master that can protect them. As Naru2 Avatar DBZ says, every leader has a certain capitulation weight. It makes leaders like Louis and Catherine easy to capitulate, while Sitting Bull, Genghis Khan, and Napoleon fight to the bitter end. And as the Mian team kind of adds to that, that's found in the XML. We really haven't talked about capitulation directly so far on this show.
That's true.
Well, the question from Sifor Rocks had something specific to do with capitulation, just kind of making it more a general topic here, since you got us started.
Mm-hmm.
Learning Civ had a few good points with regards to, in terms of an easy decision, whether or not to vassalize someone, whether or not to get them to capitulate if they're willing to do it. Current game situation, that's kind of an obvious one. Will raising unwanted cities allow another Civ to fill in the land and possibly become a lot more powerful? That's also related to, yes, okay, we need to take some cities of particular civilization to increase the likelihood that they will vassalize, but when I take those cities, do I raise them or do I keep them? I think one of the best ones in terms of directly deciding whether or not, do I want to vassalize this person? I'm already at war with them, or I'm thinking of going to war with them. Will I accept vassalization? Will I accept vassalization if I think I can't wipe them out, or do I in fact not want to wipe them out? Usually you're not wanting to wipe them out because you realize you can't because your losses would be too great. Can the vassal serve as a shield between my empire and an aggressive AI or someone I want to declare war on? I have done that on a number of occasions, giving myself a buffer. And then when the more powerful Civ or comparably powerful Civ declares war against me, I know that it's going to be a while before they get to me because they're going to run over my vassal first.
Mm-hmm. And weaken them.
Exactly. And of course, the vassal thinking I'm going to come to their defense.
Sucker.
Ha-ha.
But you also have to look at that gosh darn war weariness. Oh. That really is just as much a factor in deciding whether or not do I continue to push on to destroy them, or do I vassalize them, or from the outset you may recognize I'm not going to be able to plow through their cities in time before the war weariness gets really bad. What war weariness are we talking about? I think any war weariness 200 and under, don't worry about it. 200 to 300, you need to be start thinking about it. War weariness over 300, you really need to consider ending this war. It's actually a game I was just playing that one Civ, it was done. It was just a matter of about 5 or 10 turns. And suddenly, next turn, I find out that so-and-so, another civilization across the continent, I was playing on a standard-sized Pangaea map, vassalized the Civ that I was attacking. And so I was thinking, oh, okay, I suppose I could have a war on two fronts here, but that other civilization does have to go through so-and-so's territory to get to me, but it's later on in the game, maybe they've got some cavalry, sufficient road network, I could have something at my borders, and gosh knows what else. I didn't take my offensive force away from the front of destroying the Civ, but I beefed up, I used some gold I had in my treasury to upgrade my defensive units. Well, that vassalization was really just vassalization in name only, because I never once saw a single troop from the master. So it's not only the humans that will screw over AIs as their vassals. One AI will screw their own AI vassal.
Aha! That's good coding.
Sifor Rocks says, in response to someone who says that he takes no prisoners, I hate capitulation, because instead of them being destroyed, they're simply weakened. Vassals can still win the game. Vassals can still win the game, McGarrick, but I think it's quite unlikely that they will win the game. Anything is possible. I have yet to see a game where a Civ that it was one point a vassal actually won, and very rarely saw them being better off after being a vassal than they were before. Best game advice you ever got from I Am. Probably the most simple and useful advice I got early on was to attach a warlord to a scout explorer to create a super medic. X-Men 510. Sorry, I'm not going to do top 10 game developers, so I hope you will accept this top 10 list instead. From the thread, the top 10 best game advice you ever got.
Yeah. Ooh, top 10 list.
Number 10 from Shulek. Take nothing personal. Leave your ego at the door.
Especially in multiplayer.
Indeed. From Bostock, number 9. Ensure your city sites have enough food.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, long-term planning. Very important. From Thaddeon, number 8. You don't need an early wonder or quit. Let the AI build it for you and take it from them.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the higher difficulty levels, because you're unlikely to get the wonder anyway.
Beat them anyway.
From Gromit 5, number 7. Build a bigger stack. Oh yeah, and add elephants. Jackdog, number 6. Keep an eye on the power graph. It tells you if you're about to get trounced. Absolutely. You can tell, not just from the power graph, but also from demographics. tell you where you are in terms of ranking, for instance, number of soldiers, but it's not going to tell you who, so that graph really helps put that into context. Number 5, from Munch, siege units exist to be suicided in large numbers. I agree with the message, not exactly the phrasing of that. Suicided, oh dear. from Peace of Mind, number 4, cottages, in all caps.
That actually should be number 1. Cottages, 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 cottages. If you don't have cottages, you're doing something wrong. Deeply wrong.
I'm still trying to get a house, okay? I just, you know, the cottage is luxury. Oh, that's something else entirely. number 3 from Scribey. Use slavery. Number 2 from Alrin Carr. Specialize your cities. And number 1 best game advice you ever got from people in this thread comes from Niles. Land is power. Absolutely. Early expansion is important. Of course, without crippling your economy and the ability to defend it, but...
That's the tricky part.
Yeah. Honorable mentions, one from Extra Crispy, save before you declare war. Well, it's a single-player thing, of course. I suppose you could try that in multiplayer. Hey, man, I'm going to declare war on you next turn, so can we, like, save it in case this goes badly? Oh, sure, why not? And from Ingot, quit wasting your life on that damn computer and get a job, you bum. Whoa!
Yeah, that's the best game advice I ever ignored. Right there.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot civ issues in the forums.
Somebody wants to know, what's the point of multiplayer? Even on small maps and only a few civs, the games last so long that people don't even stick around to complete them. Well, first off, you're playing with the wrong people.
What's another point of multiplayer? You want a challenge that's different than the AI. You're either tired of the AI stupidity or, on the higher difficulty levels, annoyed with the advantages that the AI gets. They go from being too stupid to help themselves to being not quite as stupid, but full of ridiculous advantages that totally tick you off.
Hmm. If you hang out with interesting people, as opposed to just random folk, being a part of a forum, you would think would help Mr. Ruler of the People find some interesting people who won't bail on him.
I have not been playing multiplayer Civ for very long, and I just don't play with anybody. I am not a fan of GameSpy. I'm sure there are lots of GameSpy fanboys out there. And when I talk about GameSpy, I am talking about their multiplayer service. Despite the technical issues, and so this kind of actually ties into the third point, the best way to set up online multiplayer with mates, it took me a long time to play Civ 4 multiplayer. Personally, I think you need to have confidence in your single-player game before you attempt multiplayer. Confident in your single-player abilities, looking for a different way to approach the game, looking for a way to extend the longevity of the game, then go with multiplayer. And in fact, my playing multiplayer weekly since last October has increased my desire for single-player games during the week to brush up my skills for the multiplayer.
Not me!
Do they let you play on pre-settler level?
So from Ruler of the People over to Simo, he asks, what is the best way to set up online multiplayer with mates? Have one, possibly two mates with whom we are planning to have a game online. I have not played online with people I know, and only once through GameSpy when first bought it. So I'm wondering, since we know all who will be playing, do we still need GameSpy, or how would we connect our game? We are planning to play weekly, so we need to be able to keep playing, i.e. not just one night and then never again. The game will take us months. Particularly if you know who you want to play with of your Civ 4 multiplayer game, go with a direct IP connection. GameSpy has the advantage of finding people who are interested in playing the game, give you a chance to chat, give you a chance to network, and then leave the GameSpy lobby and go do direct IP. The only limitation with the direct IP is for whoever is the host of the game to have their firewall routers configured properly so the proper ports are open in order to make that possible. If you're concerned about security purposes after the Civ 4 game is over, you can always go back and close those ports and undo those modifications, and then you can go and do them again. The first time is always the most difficult, or you could just leave it be. To me, at least from my own experience and based on what the setup is, I think that that is the best way, because then you don't have to worry about GameSpy accounts, you don't have to worry about getting dropped through the GameSpy service, you're eliminating the middleman. The Civ Players Out of Sync patch, the global admin, owner, and operator of the Civilization Players League over at civplayers.com is Canuck Soldier, John Ryder, past Polycast guest co-host. He announced sometime in March, mid to late March, a solution to the out-of-sync amphibious assault bug that produces an out-of-sync error in multiplayer. As he says, quote, "This is an unofficial patch and it will not cause a mod tag," unquote, that's in the game setup. Further quote, "but it will cause a first term out of sync if all players do not have this patch," unquote. He then says, "So please encourage all multiplayers to download and install this patch. The faster this spreads, the sooner the transition period will be over," unquote. And the discussion on CFC has spread over 4 pages, and the response has been quite negative to this patch. He talks about the transition period will be over, and a lot of the position is that, good job, John, good job, Civ Players. You are splitting the multiplayer community right down the middle. You end up with people who do not want to patch and do want to patch. You also end up with people who are not comfortable with patching but want to pick up a game. You end up with people being very entrenched in their patch or anti-patch when it comes to this out-of-sync play, and that it is really hurting the Civ 4 multiplayer community. I have not tried this out-of-sync patch myself.
Based on your introduction, you know, that's quite a reputation to have. You have divided the community. Harsh.
Yeah, that thread got pretty ugly.
The out-of-sync error that's being referred to is a later game out-of-sync. The 3.17 patch for Beyond the Sword, which is the latest patch for Beyond the Sword and highly speculated to be the last official patch from Firaxis, Civ 4's developer, of course. They introduced a bug that results in players getting out of sync when performing an amphibious landing by moving transports directly onto an enemy-occupied tile. Back on the 19th of February, Alexman Manzares, who was the co-lead on Beyond the Sword with John Schaefer, known as Trip in our community, said, "Here is how to fix it." He referenced a piece of code and said, "Change this piece of code to this other piece of code." Where some people are not comfortable in doing that, so one individual in the CFC community, Peace of Mind, said, "Here is the fixed file." What had happened is that he fixed it and then did the recompiling, whatever was required. Talks about backing up the current DLL file that's referenced in there, says where it's found, and then place this updated DLL file to address this issue. Having said that, kind of an overview, my biggest concern with this patch is that it does not cause a modification tag in the setup. Yes, I understand the concerns about dividing the community. I think in the GameSpy lobby, for instance, it would be advantageous to have in the game name in brackets, like OOS patch. And if people don't know about that, then people can be informed about it. But that way, just at a glance, referring specifically to the GameSpy lobby. If you've been playing with a group of people and you're not able to come to a consensus whether or not you're going to be running this patch, then I guess those of you who think you should be playing it, you guys need to have a game, do want to run it and don't want to run it. Split yourself off in that way. This is a modification to the game, and the mod tag is important. When you're setting up multiplayer, in addition to seeing that mod tag, you should get a pop-up dialogue that says, "Player whatever is using a different version. Make sure that they are a trusted player." And you click OK, and then you see mod right in the setup of the game. I do not know why, and maybe I missed it, but I do not know why there is no mod tag in there, other than the fact that when people run it, they didn't want that pop-up dialogue box to appear. So instead of having the mod tag, it causes a first turn out of sync if players do not already have this patch. It would be advantageous so that everybody knows whether everybody is running this patch or not, before you even start to play the game. Why start the game and then have an out of sync in the first turn? It's a later game out of sync error as well. I mean, we're talking about amphibious assault. Players that really want to consider this patch might be those who go on advanced starts, or they otherwise start in a later game era when it's more likely that your multiplayer game is going to get to this point. Of all the multiplayer games I've played since October of last year, that's about 20 to 25 now. Only once has it gotten to the point of amphibious assault, and I was on the receiving end of that assault, so I really don't like to think about it anyway. When I started reading the thread, I didn't realize until I started reading the comments just how angry some people are about this. I understand the frustration to a degree. There's absolutely no problem to me in raising constructive criticisms. Some people have resorted to personal attacks, which of course is totally hurting your argument, totally counterproductive.
Going through this thing, and yeah, it actually gets kind of interesting with everyone piling on Canuck Soldier and him like, well, I'm sorry, but 5,000 people have downloaded it, so I don't know what's wrong with you.
At the end of the day, you read about the patch, what it is, why it exists, what it addresses, and how it addresses it, and then make a decision whether or not you are going to run it. And then, with the people you are playing with or have been playing with, make sure that you have a consensus about whether or not you are going to run the patch. Canuck Soldier has said that the uninstallation is about as quick as the installation in about 30 seconds.
But that's annoying.
It is.
And I'm a little confused because he says in Post 48 we didn't do a mod because the mechanism, when you load a mod, you have to reboot the game and see a separate game list if you have a mod, and then you have to reboot the game to get rid of the mod if you don't want to see mods. Isn't that what you're doing if you install and uninstall the patch? You're rebooting the game?
Yeah, that's true. I think the biggest problem with not having the mod tag is that there are other things to discuss when it comes to the gameplay, game settings, whether or not you're running this. People who have the patch think everybody else has the patch. The people who don't have the patch think nobody has the patch. And then they get into the game, and then you get an out-of-sync error. It's possible that you're not going to know right away, or the question might not come up right away, oh, I wonder if they're running the amphibious assault patch. When I've seen an out-of-sync error, that certainly has never been my question. Is someone running a particular mod? We shouldn't have to worry about that modification, because if there was a mod, then there would be the mod tag at the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He says you don't want to have to load the mod because then you have to reboot the game, but you have to do that anyway if you have to install and uninstall for people that have it or don't have it, so I don't get it. Well, it wasn't up to me.
Since this is coming from Civ players, for instance, in their leagues, if they insist that people run the patch, then you could certainly disagree with that, but it is their league.
Right.
If they want to support it that way, then that's their choice, just like it's then your choice whether or not you're going to continue to play in the league. As someone says, well, what we do is since we know that the bug exists, we avoid doing exactly what is described.
Yeah.
And I can understand how people are frustrated, because, you know, say they're joining it and they don't know anything about it. They're like, wait, I got to download an unofficial patch to play? What the hell is this?
And particularly people new to multiplayer are probably also uncomfortable with something that's not officially from Firaxis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And everybody just wants to play the game. Nobody's trying to ruin the game. So it's frustrating for everybody, I'm sure.
Well, the other thing that can be done, you can play with the out-of-sync, right? To make the out-of-sync notice thing a little bit smaller. Post-10 Octavian flu, what it looks like. And it's a big red thing in the middle that says, this game has gone out of sync, please check OSS values, blah, 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 blah.
It is quite obvious in that way, but if you are out of sync, it's important that you see that it's out of sync. It's true that you can continue to play when it's out of sync, but you are asking for something to happen in the time that you get the out of sync error, and then you continue to play on, and then the game can run into even more difficulties where everything that you've done certainly post out of sync is lost, and you'd have to go do it again. That's why it's so prominent. Yes, it's annoying, but it's purposely annoying. That I find annoying about the out of sync is when it's flashing, and if it's telling you to check the values, it flashes for like a second or half a second, and then disappears for a few seconds, and then comes back. It'd be nice if it just stayed solid, so then at a quick glance, we can see the OSS values, and I don't have to wait for it to blink half a dozen times so my eyes can check what the values are. It's like, okay, I saw my out of sync. Okay, it's gone again. Okay, I'll check this person. Oh, no, it's gone again.
Yeah, no, it goes flash, 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 flash. How am I supposed to read who's out of sync?
It seems I am more, let's say, sympathetic towards those who are on the other side of Mr. Canuck Soldier.
Research study about Civilization players. A 57-item questionnaire. It's for masters, and he's at York University, one of my alma maters, as a matter of fact.
No wonder you linked to it.
Survey only takes about 10 minutes, and your response is greatly appreciated. Yeah, the survey did only take me about 10 minutes. Thomas Bach, if you decide to provide a summary of your research findings, say, in this thread, even for people who prefer not to contact you directly, and then you could share it with anybody. And that would also mean that you could share the results with people who only find this after the survey period is over. The biggest beef was that one of the things it asked you is what leader you prefer to play, and he only listed Vanilla Civ.
And no random.
Yes, and there was no random option to choose either, which is what I do almost always now.
Which I never do, but I noticed it wasn't there.
Some of the questions, some people were saying the choices were kind of strange. Some replies were missing, such as situational instead of agreeing or not agreeing.
Yeah, some were quite odd.
Yeah, like Fungus420 said, I gave up on your survey after this question, which is choose one of the following, which most closely matches. I don't like it when I find myself manipulating people, or I find it easy to manipulate people. But as he says, these are not mutually exclusive options. So I guess in situations like that, you can't either give up on the survey because you think that the results you're getting are going to be invalid or at the very least skewed because of the choices that you've limited it to. Or you just recognize that I've got to choose the answer that best fits. And that's what I did. What was not clear to me from taking the survey is how is he going to tie in, for instance, the first questions, which is how long have you played the series? How often do you play against computer players? How often do you play against human players? What difficulty level do you play at most? What type of victory do you use most often? How are you going to tie that data? What conclusions are you going to be able to draw from that? And the particular questions, which were either check either or, and then the 5 scale strongly disagree to strongly agree scale. What is it that he's trying to answer in his thesis?
I really have no idea.
There is no time limit right now on the survey. It doesn't say how long you have. You do need to be at least 18 years of age, or at least be willing to say you're 18 years of age.
Sorry, Joe Coolio.
So I wish you luck with your master's thesis on this, Thomas, whatever it is that you're going for. You're purposely leaving us in the dark, although I understand you're not telling us what you think the results are going to be or what you think the relations are going to be, because then that could affect the input that you're receiving, but...
Calling today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast.
Or email us at polycast@apolton.net.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at polycast.apolton.net.
You've been listening to episode 66, the Satanist episode of Polycast, the official podcast of Polton Civilization site. I have been Imran Siddiqui, and joined by this motley crew consisting of Daniel Quick.
Isn't that Satan Jr., though? Because we're missing a 6.
Moving on, Makalua.
Bye.
Cardamandua.
Bye, everyone.
And joined by our old friend, K-Mad.
Bye.
Wow, you called a woman old and you got away with it.
Yeah, he's allowed to this time.
I said old friend.
Yeah, old friend is a bit different. That's okay.
Do the R-rated countdown.
Yeah, she hasn't heard that.
No, I'm not going to do the R-rated countdown.
Oh,
today.
Please.
A request. Oh, jeez.
You shouldn't have asked.
All right. It's 3 words, so instead of a countdown from 3, it's, go.
All right.
Oh, my goodness.
We're hilarious.
Exactly. We should put that in the outtake now. We're hilarious. And then just like 5 minutes of us laughing.
We are the lols.
We are the lols.
I thought you were going to make me do the closing, and I was like, oh no, I'm going to mispronounce everything wrong.
Wait, if you're going to mispronounce everything wrong.
Oh.
It's a double negative. I mean, you're going to pronounce everything right? All right.
Look, teacher.
You're such a teacher, Dan.
It's the weekend. Turn your brain off.
Record date April 4th, 2009. Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright 2009, Poulton Civilization site at apoulton.net.